So guys, I'll just talk into that. How about that? A couple things to take care of. One is that I am not traveling with Tom and Mark this weekend. Appreciate them doing that. Been a little bit involved in that since it happened with Jay Dixon. Appreciate these guys. Appreciate all of you contributing. I know some of you have given the money to me to give to them. And so you can go ahead and just give that to Tom or Mark. And they'll be taking that with them when they go down Thursday. Second weekend in December is our annual trip with some of our kids and a couple families to Western North Carolina. So we'll be gone from Thursday, God willing, through next Monday. So, and the other thing is, I mentioned it Wednesday night, just for fun. Want to make sure that I cleared up the major confusion that I caused last Sunday. And that I know my friend did not drive a semi 15 years for 1.2 trillion miles. I knew it when I said it, but it didn't sound it right. It's 1.2 million. So don't do things like that in front of a bunch of engineers. That's all I know. So it's still a wonderful thing for me to go through the book of Acts and to try to experience the work of God's people, His work being done in the lives of His apostles and His church throughout the book of Acts. It wasn't all easy, and it wasn't without problems. When we think about the God's people before the day of Pentecost, there were about 120 disciples. Someone has said there really isn't very many, considering how many people Jesus taught. There were about 120 gathered together. And Peter stood up in the midst of them and told them they needed to replace Judas. And apparently that was an environment in which they could all hear him speak. Just a few days later, about 3,000 people on the day of Pentecost heard gospel preaching, were convicted in their hearts that Jesus was the Christ and the Messiah, that they had had part in his death. And when they heard that message and pled with Peter and the apostles, what should we do? They were told what they needed to do, and about 3,000 were baptized for the remission of their sins. Those continued to meet in the temple, probably because that's where the apostles were gathering, so they could hear more teaching from them. They abode strongly and consistently in the teaching of the apostles. And not only that, but they ate together, and they ate from house to house. Acts chapter 2. I don't think any of us, as we read a passage like that, try to draw some inferences, whether those are even necessary or not. I don't know that all 3,000 came to the temple every day. And I certainly don't think that the 3,000 were going from one house one day and one house to the other. That hospitality would have been spread out among the individual members and families as they particularly were entertaining or taking care of those who had traveled many miles to worship in Jerusalem and now were Christians. And so they were looking after their needs. The growth continued. Many Jews, after the healing of the lame man in Acts chapter 3, ran together to Peter and John in Solomon's porch. I haven't done the research. I don't know how large that area was, but large enough to accommodate several people, 1,000 perhaps, so they could hear Peter preach. And he preached to them, and the number of believers continued to grow until chapter 4. There were 5,000 men, it states, at that point in time. Believers were increasingly being added to the Lord, Acts 5 and verse 14. There were many that were sick, and many that were filled with unclean spirits, or tormented by unclean spirits, and they were healed, Acts chapter 5, verses 15 and 16. The apostles continued teaching in chapter 5, even after being beaten by the council, rejoiced that they could suffer for the cause of Jesus, and they continued preaching in the temple and from house to house. All of us who preach and teach desire to preach and teach publicly and privately. And the word of God spread, and the number of disciples multiplied greatly in Jerusalem, and a great many of the priests were obedient to the faith. Acts chapter 6 and verse number 7. The word spread. When the gospel continued to be preached and more people heard the gospel, heard the story of Jesus and were pricked in their hearts, many of them came to realize they needed the salvation that was offered to them by Jesus. They needed the forgiveness of their sins, and they found that gladly and joyfully in Jesus Christ. It wasn't until a great persecution led by you-know-who, Saul at the time, caused many of the disciples to scatter. Some have suggested that was the plan of God, the providence of God. It was time to get all of those people who had come from every nation under heaven to get them to go back home and to take the message that they had heard in Jerusalem with them. And the Bible tells us, and they, the disciples, not the apostles, but the disciples were scattered, going everywhere preaching the word. That passage teaches us individual responsibility. It has nothing to do with the disciples forming churches and then sending money to preachers. It's a part of our work, we'll notice. But in that passage, it is the, and ought to be, the desire of every Christian to tell others about Jesus. We move on to Acts chapter 11, where Paul and Barnabas gathered in Antioch for about a year. And they taught many people during that year as they gathered with the church there in that city where disciples were called Christians first. In Acts 12, not an assembly, I don't think, of an entire church in Jerusalem, but many gathered in Mary's house to pray. Paul and Barnabas, on one of their preaching trips, in fact, the end of the first preaching trip, gathered the church at Antioch together, got them together to report what God had done with them, Acts 14:27. In Acts 19, Paul had found himself in Ephesus again, and he got to preach to some individuals who needed to be baptized again, about 12 of them. He continued to go in the synagogue and teach and preach, received some conflict, some opposition, the word I'm looking for, and he decided to take the disciples with him into the school of Tyrannus, and there met for a good while, I think, remember, 2 years, and preaching the gospel. So the Bible says that says all in Asia heard the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so the gospel continued to be preached, the message of Jesus and him crucified, and men and women were being turned to the Lord as they heard the gospel. We find in Acts 20 and verse 7, the disciples at Troas came together on the first day of the week to break bread. It was on the third story where they met on that particular occasion, and Paul preached to them, probably anticipating that he would never be able to do that again. I believe we can know what the work of the Lord is in local churches. I believe as we read the New Testament and even in the epistles, we can see where Christians came together to pray. They came together to eat the Lord's Supper, to have fellowship, communion with each other as we studied in our Bible class. They came together to sing. They came together to hear teaching and preaching. They took up a collection for the saints on the first day of the week, 1 Corinthians 16. That collection was used for Christians who were in need and the support of those who preached the gospel. I believe those are things we can know, simply stated in the New Testament. I want to add something before I come back to probably the main point of the lesson tonight, or the main point or two. I want to think about unbelievers in the assemblies, and you'll see, I'll make a connection with this a little bit later. I almost thought about deleting this section, but I decided against it just to make this point. Did local churches, Christians, invite their neighbors to come to church with them? Certainly, we would anticipate they would have. And if they didn't feel qualified to teach them themselves, they were bringing them in hopes that they would hear some teaching and preaching that would reach into their hearts. We read in chapter 14 where some had come together, and in the assembly when the whole church had come together in one place, that there were unbelievers in that audience. Again, the work of evangelism should never be confined to only what we do in the building. It's a part of it. JD and I and anybody else that stands in this pulpit on Wednesday night or any other time to talk about the Lord and His Word are hopeful that there's someone in the audience that's listening that's not a believer, that their heart will be turned to the Lord and they will want to obey the Lord. That's our desire, the teaching. And not only that, but to edify one another, to encourage us who are already believers. Those of us who preach like this are much like Timothy and Titus. We're not inspired any more than they were. And they had to take the letters from Paul and the rest of the New Testament and to teach churches like the church at Ephesus and the churches on the island of Crete as God guided them with His word to preach and teach the people. That was going on in these first century assemblies, even with the spiritual gifts that were given to the people. But what did they do to get them there? What was the draw when they tried to invite people to come into their assemblies? What would it have been about the assemblies and the work and the worship of that local church that would have been attractive to anybody, to a co-worker, to somebody that you met at the marketplace and shopped there often and gotten to know, or somebody you've gone to the theater with, or your kids were in a play together with, or whatever it may have been in those cities that was going on in their daily social life, people you worked with, when you invited them to come, what would you have used to try to get them to come? What would they have used? And I think it's, again, very simple. They were wanting people to come and hear the gospel of Jesus Christ. What convinced these in chapter 14 that God was among them? It's a remarkable picture of someone being in that assembly and falling, worshiping God and falling on His face, the secrets of his heart being revealed. I think that's a reference to his own sins. He sees them, and he knows God sees them. And he falls on his face before God, pleading perhaps, wanting the forgiveness that perhaps he had heard preached about in that assembly. And he would worship God. He would honor the Lord, fear the Lord. And then he would say, God is truly among you. Why would God say that? Why would they say that in that assembly? Again, I think it was simply because of the teaching they were hearing. Perhaps it did have something to do with the miracles. Tongues were assigned to unbelievers, chapter 14, verse 22. We know from other passages that miracles and signs and wonders were given to Jesus and especially to the apostles, as Jesus promised in Mark 16, 20, that they would confirm the message. And when people saw the miracles and healings were a considerable part of Jesus' work and the work of the apostles, it was the healing of a paralyzed man that led many turning to the Lord in Lydda in Acts chapter 9, verses 33 through 35. God worked unusual miracles by the hands of Paul in Ephesus in Acts 19 and verse 11. They brought handkerchiefs to him and said, touch this. And then they'd take it home and lay it on their sick son or daughter or brother or sister, and they'd get well. Incredible stuff. Amazing things going on that would have caused people to wonder. Paul said, truly the signs of an apostle were accomplished among you in 2 Corinthians 12:12, that while he was with them, he worked miracles and signs among them. And then, of course, he could have laid hands on them, and then there were some among them that could do miracles. That would have been appealing to draw people to the assemblies. These fantastic, amazing works that God worked in his people. There were a couple of occasions in the days of Jesus where Jesus fed thousands in a miraculous way. You remember those stories. Many were coming to hear him preach, and sometimes they had come and listened to him preach. They had traveled a ways, and Jesus wasn't a short-winded preacher a lot of times. And he preached a long time, and there they were listening. And they got tired, and it was getting nighttime, getting close to night, and they hadn't eaten anything all day. And so Jesus fed them. Jesus recognized there was always a danger that the miracles would provide those that had seen them and experienced them. We read in John chapter 6 that there were several who had been fed. They didn't know where Jesus went. He'd gone on the other side of Galilee, and so many of them got in boats, and they got to the other side, and they found Jesus. And they didn't hear from Jesus probably what they expected to hear from him. And he said to them in verse 26 of John 6, "Most assuredly I say to you, you seek me, not because you saw the signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled." You know, the miracles eventually ceased. 1 Corinthians 13. At some point, even those things that were right in and of themselves came to an end. Which is a strange thing to me, if what the Lord cared the most about was people being healed of their sicknesses and making sure they had enough food to eat. That's not to say that individually as Christians we have wonderful opportunities to help others and that we ought to do that. If there's a man beaten alongside the road, we ought to be there like the Samaritan to help them. Jesus taught a parable about taking care of others. But it sure seems to me that if that was the drawing power that God would not have stopped offering these miracles. I believe it was the teaching that eventually caused visitors to declare that God was among those people. I believe eventually it was simple New Testament worship. It probably wasn't the place where they met. It was what they did in their assemblies. I'm asking you tonight, as you and I think about the work and worship of local churches, we're inviting folks to come, and I hope you are. I hope what you want them to see and hear is the gospel of Jesus Christ. I hope what you want them to hear is Jesus Christ and Him crucified. I hope what you want them to hear is the whole counsel of God. I hope what you want them to hear is they can be saved by grace in Jesus Christ from the wrath of God. Now I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about things I have no idea. Up to this point, I've been pretty sure. But I'm going to address some questions I have been asked to address. I know they assembled. We just don't know where. In a meeting a while back, someone says, well, perhaps they met in synagogues. You really don't find local churches meeting in synagogues. You find Paul going to synagogue, preaching to people who aren't Christians yet, telling them about Jesus. Then when they obeyed the gospel, I don't know if the rulers of the synagogues allowed them to meet on the first day of the week to break bread. Seems a little unusual to me, perhaps that's the case. But there's no consistency in that. I mentioned Acts chapter 19, where Paul took a group of disciples, and for a while they met in a school building. I think I probably told you before, I grew up in Seymour, and the church building where I first attended as a little infant, I'm sure. I was, like I said, born and raised there from my first days of my life. And we met in the church building there. I drove by it the other day. It's a private residence, but it still has Church of Christ in a stone in the bricks above the door. But while we lived there, my first 10 years, the church there built the new building they're in now. And during that time, we met in the cafeteria of the Reading Grade School where I attended. I thought that was pretty cool. And anyway, we met right in the cafeteria on Sundays and worshiped there. Do you not have houses to eat and drink in? Paul said in 1 Corinthians 11:22. I don't know what all to make of that. I don't even know if that means the Corinthians had a building to meet in. I just don't know. It may be more than just, it was just Paul keeping the Lord's Supper separate from just a common everyday meal. This is not just that. It's not that at all. And they seem to be making it that in some way or another. But some have implied from the statement, don't you have houses to eat and drink in, that they had a meeting place. I don't know if that's a necessary inference. And I think one of the more popular ideas, and even in our day, and has been kind of popularized by some particular writers about us getting back to our New Testament patterns, and that is churches met in homes. Paul, on several occasions, Romans 16, 1 Corinthians 16, Philemon 2, verse 2, Colossians 4, and verse 15, spoke of disciples and said and referred to or greeted the church in their house. I've asked some folks, does that mean anything besides the idea the church was meeting in their home? And they said, it sounds like what it means to me. So maybe they were meeting in homes. Robertson simply says the early Christians had no church buildings. That the Roman Christians, probably several of them, would have had homes where they would meet. So what about this building? We have authority for this? In the next few moments, I'm going to address just a couple of questions and anxiously get to a close of my lesson where I think I can get back to talk about things that we'll all agree on. I'm pretty sure in the next few moments I'm going to say some things. These are matters of judgment. And I'm going to say some things that not everybody's going to agree with. I know that. Buildings create questions. I know that. Folks are asking questions like, we spend 4 hours a week in this building. It's a lot of money built for a church building that we only spend 4 hours a week. What else can we do with the building? What would God want us to do with the building? Questions about expedience. These are questions that are matters of judgment. Sometimes I have to shake my head a little bit that we end up making rules about using an expedient. And somebody says that sounds a lot like the Pharisees. Maybe it is. I don't think the building is holy. I don't think it was the temple, that it's the temple or a parallel of the temple. But I do understand that it was built with funds that were collected from the members. All of us had a part in this and continue to have a part in it when we contribute because we're still paying the bills. I assume, is this church building paid for? Okay, I thought it probably was. We still got to pay the electric, still got to pay whatever other bills we have to pay to provide a place for us to come together and do things that we know God wants us to do together. What other arrangements would you suggest? Has the Lord said anything about the use of these funds for church buildings? Not a word. Not a word. He didn't say anything specific about buildings. Again, church buildings are just an expedient to the command to assemble. The question does come back to what can we use the money collected on the first day of the week for? Is it the Lord's money? Do we have to be particularly careful about how we use it? And I suggest that in some sense, yes, we do, because God has given us some instructions about the collection and who it's for. But as we work through some questions, I've got some questions about, are they a reflection of what we think the work and worship of local churches should entail? And I think all of us want to worship as God commanded. We want our work, whatever we may do collectively, and believe me, this is about the point that I started to go in another direction, another sermon, and that's for another time. We need to talk about what a local church is and what we can and cannot do. Can we find a way not to have and own a building? Perhaps. The folks at Avon rented a place for years. They were able to do whatever they wanted with that facility. That was an interesting relationship where they could go in and build on and add to and do whatever they wanted. But they finally left there running out of parking place. And so they bought a building. It used to be used by Hindus. Isn't that interesting? When I first heard that, I thought, I could see a Hindu temple in my head, but apparently that building, whatever connection it had, looked anything like that. Anyway, do we start meeting in our homes? How many of us would be willing to have smaller churches? How many of us asking the questions about the use of a church building would be willing to go smaller, to meet in homes? Would you and I be willing to do that work? Churches, so many opinions even about the size of churches. I worked with an elder that thought at 75 it was time to start a new group. That's his opinion, in a small town in Kentucky. Do you like having a bigger church? You like having more people? There's some blessings in all of that. Would we be willing, if we were meeting in our home, as we were out preaching the gospel, would we still be doing the work, even though regardless of the arrangement? Would you still be talking to your neighbors and your co-workers and the family members of the kids your kids play ball with? And the lady down at the grocery store? And your neighbors, would you still be talking to them? And they come and you're preaching the gospel and they obey the gospel and they become a part of the group. And the next thing you know, your room in your house is, what are you going to do? Are you going to start in another group? Again, so many opinions. I will tell you that it's hard work, the smaller a church is. You say, Lee, what in the world are you talking about? I know a church about 300 to 400 people right now. I know a couple who wanted to go start another group several miles away from that group. And they couldn't find anybody interested. Because that takes work. It's easy to come into a group of large people and just kind of be there. And I'm not suggesting all of you or any of you are doing that. But you've got to consciously decide in a larger church to come in and say, what can I do? What am I going to do? How can I be a worker here? When you might meet with a smaller group and have to work to grow and to teach and all the things that are involved in making a local church everything the Lord wants us to be. When I start thinking about what are we going to use the building for, I do think about whether or not we want to burden the elders. What do we want to burden them with overseeing? What other activities do we want to participate and use the building for and put them in a position of overseeing? There may be a number of things that churches in the world today do with their buildings. Some churches have become businesses in a lot of ways. What about schools and preschools and daycares, and maybe they call that a preschool a lot of times, and other things that local churches are using their buildings for. Of course, some churches have built on facilities where they can, you know, have plays, and you know, homeschool groups can use them, school groups can use them, they use them. Yeah, they build facilities to do things that we would find outside the realm of what local churches did in the first century. What about weddings and funerals? I called three preachers today and got three different answers. I called one of them. He didn't get back to me until I was sitting in the parking lot. And I said, I got a question for you. He said, I'm done. He hung up on me. Not quite. I get different responses. I'm not going to settle that tonight, folks. Is it a work of the church? Is it a chance to teach the gospel? Will having weddings and church buildings lead to us, somebody going, well, why don't we just build a wedding venue? I've never seen that happen. Is it going to lead to using the building for other things? And you want my judgment about it? You want a beautiful wedding? Not here. Yeah, you probably use this for free, but there's a lot more intimate from a guy who doesn't think about that very much, but think that would be a better thing to do. Somebody asked me a question about, I hadn't thought about this, weddings and funerals for only church members? So brother and sister so-and-so have got a son that's not a Christian. And he's getting married, and they come to the elders and say, we'd like to have, our son would like to have his wedding in this building. Okay. And then somebody asked this. Somebody has a daughter, and she wants to use the building for a wedding to marry her wife. Yeah, there could be legal issues down the road once we open that floodgates. But I, you know what? I'm content about this. I'm content with elders making decisions. I'm content with an eldership deciding we're just not going to do it. We're not going to do it. We're just going to eliminate the question. I talked to a fellow, and two of the fellows I talked about used to be on the other side of institutional questions. That's one of the reasons I asked them. And one of them said, I'm thankful the elders where I am have decided a long time ago, we're just not going to have funerals and weddings in the building. Eliminate the question. I said, they've only had one time. She was very disappointed. Been a man, been there a long time. And his wife passed away, and he wanted to have the funeral in the building. They said, you know, we made that decision not to do that. And he got mad and left. I got to be honest. I think I know who has the problem in that story. You know, when elders make some decisions and about judgments about buildings, I'm just going to be willing to submit to that. You know, I don't believe churches should build facilities to eat and play in. But you know, I'm not opposed to having a work day here and we stop to eat lunch in the building. I'm not opposed to me personally eating lunch in my office. Those are incidental uses of the building. I have a problem with that. Some people would have. Some people like to raise the question of the slippery slope. If we start doing this, what's next? Some people think that's an unfair question. But it's happened over and over. If we can do this, why can't we do this? So somewhere along the line, somebody's going to have to say, okay. And we're uncomfortable with that. And at the end of the day, and I'm going to move on to things I know, that you can know. Do any of us want to do anything that others might object to, and for it to be a divisive issue? Isn't Romans 14 in this picture a little bit? And I can hear the person over here saying, Lee, I think we can have weddings and funerals in the building. And somebody over here says, I don't think we can have weddings and funerals in the building. Okay, who's the strong, weak brother in that story? Well, you ask whichever one you want, you're going to get an opposite answer. But the one over here says, I think we can. He thinks he's the strong brother. Well, listen, okay, you think this is the weak brother who says he doesn't think we can, and he gives you a 25-page article about why he doesn't think we can, as I was asked to read. Do you say, okay, we don't have to do this. I'm not going to force my will. Would you do that? And somebody said, but he shouldn't tell this person over there that it's necessarily wrong. Sometime when questions like this arise, because we have a building, I understand we wouldn't have this question. If we were meeting in somebody's home and we met and worshiped in a room, and then after we were done, somebody moved the furniture around, put tables out, we ate, we wouldn't have a question with that. If they wanted to have a wedding in the same room, we wouldn't have a question about that. But the question has been raised because we've taken money from the treasury and we built this facility. And we're just going to have to wrestle with those questions. But I believe we can avoid divisive issues and get on to doing the things we know we should be doing. And that is ultimately focused on the work of the Lord. I've got a couple questions. What are you and I doing personally in the work of the Lord? You know, if somebody comes to me and I know how active they are. I know they've got a Bible study or two going with somebody, and I know they're showing hospitality. I know they're active, they're teaching Bible classes. I just know their character, and they come to me and they raise some of these questions. Is it sometimes we're just not doing what we ought to be doing? Are you and I participating in all the activities that are conducted in this building? If we're raising questions about how to use it, are you involved in every activity that we use this building for? That means every gospel meeting, all of the opportunities to come together here to worship together. Are we taking part in those activities? I want to use it more. And use it for singing and reading and praying and teaching, doing the things that God wants us to do together. But again, what am I doing personally? There's way too much of what are we doing. Way too much of that in local churches. What are we doing? The Lord's not going to ask you that day of judgment. He's going to ask you what you did. Judgment's individual. What did I do? Am I teaching anybody about Jesus? Am I teaching anyone? Do I have any Bible studies going on with anyone? How many of us are preaching the word, Acts 8 and verse number 4? Use the building for that. Set up Bible studies. Come here. Use. I was at Charlestown Road back in August, and I'm walking down the highway. And of course, I think most of you know their building design like this one. They've done a few things different. I was walking down the one of the fast Rogers office and went on down the room, and I looked in that room. And I got to tell you, 30 years ago, I looked in that room and said, well, these are a bunch of liberals. And I looked in that room, and it looked like a living room. It had a couch and a nice seat over here and chair, and had a little coffee table out there. And it just looked like you just walked in a nice, comfortable room. And I thought, that's pretty cool. Elders need to meet with somebody and get them out of this old, cold classroom and get them in a comfortable environment. Now, again, the other question is, why not just invite them to your house? You could do that too. Let's use the building. How am I using my home? How am I using my resources? You know, instead of us thinking about having large church gatherings to eat and whether or not we could do this in the building, move the chairs out and have a meal. We could have a pretty good sized half court basketball in here too, by the way. Anybody want to move the chairs and get that set up somewhere? We'd be replacing light bulbs, because I watched Brownie Reeves one night in a rec center throw the ball up in the air and bust one of those. What do we want the world to know that we're about? Are you using your home for hospitality? My dear brothers and sisters, we have a gospel meeting, goes Sunday through Wednesday. A meal list is put up on the board on Sunday. The Monday slot is blank. I just made some people feel bad. And I'll tell you, the people I just made feel bad are probably the ones that don't need to feel bad. You're now going, how come I didn't do that? I know people who won't put their names up there because they're usually ones who do put their names up there, hoping that somebody else will this week, this time. Empty blank on a chance to provide hospitality to a gospel preacher. We don't even do that. So let's step up. What about visitors? We've got folks here that when visitors come in this door, they're going up to them and say, I'm going to take you out to lunch today. And it doesn't take very many people like that to impress others with how friendly a group we are. I appreciate that. I know that happens. What about new members? What about neighbors? What about neighbors you want to get to know, have a Bible study with? Get them thinking about spiritual things. Betsy and I did that. I'm not, patting ourselves on the back. There's a couple about two houses down from us. I got talking to them one day, and I said, would you come over? And they came over. We spent some time together. I don't know where that's going to go. We're going to try it again. And if it doesn't pan out that they show any interest, I got other neighbors too. Pray for me. I need to invite the ones next to me who are so concerned about their yard and mine. But anyway, that's another story. Smile. Somebody said, could we have a kitchen if we had widows that needed food? Probably. If we had widows that were in need and the church can take care of those widows, that widows indeed, 1 Timothy 5, could we have a kitchen where the meals were prepared? Probably. But can I ask you something? You have a kitchen in your house? If the elders come to you and say, Lee, Betsy, Sister so-and-so over here, she's yours. We want you to take care of her. I think we'd take care of that. Three things, brethren, I want us to do, and I want you to help me do it, and I want to help you do it. I want us to grow to love even more what we can do together. I want us to love to worship. I want us to love to sing. I want us to love to come together to pray. I want us to love to come together and hear teaching and preaching of the gospel. I want us to love to do the work we do. I want us to be excited about the men that we support. I want all of you to read every report when Gene sends them out. I want you to start sending some of those fellows notes when you get those reports. And I want you to be looking for others that need support and passing that information on to the elders. I want us to be excited about that and find more occasions to do more of that and to use the money for the things, the very things that the Lord wants us to use it for. Let's grow in that way. I want you and I, both, all of us individually, to increase in our faith and our love. to increase in our love for others. I think when I've read that passage in times past, like in Thessalonians, Paul was urging them to increase in love for others. That doesn't necessarily mean I need to raise the level of love I have for you. It means that I need to love more people. I need to include more in my life. I need to bring others in to my circle and encourage them. We can all do better. This church takes care of their own very, very well. I'm going to stop and say that right now. I want to make sure I say something very positive. I am impressed and encouraged by how much we look out for one another. Whether it's the news and the notes, the announcements, the messages that come via our website, that we care about each other. We ought to do that. We ought to do good to all men, but especially to those of the household of faith. So keep on doing it. If there's more you can do, then I'm urging you tonight to think about doing that. Get more individually involved in the Lord's work. Let's be busy in His work, and let's encourage our elders to lead us in the work that we have the authority to do. And still now and then have to grapple with some questions and do that with love, compassion, patience, and understanding. And I hope tonight I've done that. The last thing I do, and I tell you what, I believe if the elders ask me to preach on this again, they're going to have to fire me. Because I'm going to look at them and say, no, I'm done. Because I want to be preaching about things I know we can do, and I want to encourage you to do it. I want to be a better example myself. I told Betsy today, we have got, now that we're going to hopefully slow down, get more people in this house. Because there's just haven't done enough of that. And I look forward to that. I look forward to us continue to grow and helping each other. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your patience. I know you want to do what's good and what's right. People are asking honest questions. Good hearts, sincere. And I hope this has been a feeble but honest attempt to try to make sure we keep ourselves together, working together for the cause of the one who died on the cross for me and you. There's someone in our audience tonight, if you're one of those, and I doubt this is probably the sermon that would have moved you to this point, but makes you think about God. And you want Him, you want to worship Him, and you're ready to serve Him. And if there are visitors in this audience tonight, and I thought about this in my notes, I want you to know, please, please, please come back. And realize that we're not just a bunch of folks that sit around and wrestle with these questions all the time. So every now and then, gotta do it. But we're going to press on to the things that you can know and do, and we want you to know we'd be glad to help you obey the gospel. As we stand and sing, will you come if we can help you right now?